It's a little bit after 4 o'clock here on KDNK, and you are tuned to Everything Under the Sun, a little half-hour news segment with me, Will, the editor of the Soper Sun, and guests relevant to what we put out in the paper this week. On this particular occasion, I have with me in the studio Lacey Dunlavy, the librarian over at the Carbondale Library.
Hey, Will.
And Rob Goodwin, the Carbondale Fire Chief.
Hello.
And we're going to catch up a little bit. If you've talked to either of these folks in about the past 3 months about the election, they've probably been a little cagey with you because there are some pretty strict rules about what employees of publicly funded institutions can say when there's something on the ballot. But now both of their institutions are looking forward to a little bit of extra funding, and we're going to chat with them about what that means for the organization. So Rob, Carbondale Fire has been kind of on a yo-yo of funding for a little bit here with some 2 or 3 year mill levy increases. It's been a while since the last bond, although it's got a couple more years to be paid off. The last time that Carbondale Fire pursued a big mill levy override with no sunset, it failed. This year it succeeded. So you guys have, you're kind of sitting pretty for a little bit here.
Yeah, we are. It's good. And I really think this was the culmination of about 5 years worth of work, because back when 2013 and when it failed, one of the things we knew was our old master plan was ending 2014, and we did the citizens task force and had community meetings and did that for almost a year. And then one of the things that came out of that was, hey, you need a new master plan, and we agreed with that. And so in 2014 we commissioned that, and at early 2015 we had a new master plan, and we've been trying our best to follow it, and we're now going to be really able to do that and execute it. But in the meantime, like you had said, we had just funding issues where we did these short-term 2-year mill levy overrides to try to tide us over. But this year, we just kind of put it out there. This is what we believe, based on what we've been doing, that we need to fund this place moving forward. And the response is very positive. So we're very grateful.
So what specifically should people expect to see done with the funds once they start coming in? I'm assuming next year is when you'll see that.
Yeah, nothing as far as the bond issue goes. Mm-hmm. That all kind of gets issued in the first part of the year. And, it takes, you have to spec a truck out if we're buying trucks, and mm-hmm. we're buying 3 or 4 engines and 3 or 4 tenders and some ambulances and brush trucks, and they all take a committee to spec it out and get bids because it's public money and all that. So that all takes a few months, and then you order it, and then it can take 4 months maybe for an ambulance, sometimes a year for a fire truck, unless you can find one that matches your mm-hmm. your needs. So it takes a little while.
So take us 2 years from now. What's Carbondale Fire going to look like?
I think you'll see 2 years from now a couple of things that will be visible. Will be, one, you'll see some newer apparatus out there, which is really important. Newer, safer apparatus, meaning fire trucks and the latest ambulances, which is really good for medical care. Mm-hmm. And then you'll also see a couple of things in our building projects, right? A training facility coming out of the ground, and in marble, you'll probably see an expansion of that station. That's very needed. And same thing with our West End station. And in the organization itself, based on the mill levy, hopefully we'll see just a continuation of really good staffing of calls. And like we've talked in the past, Will, of concurrent calls mm-hmm. and things like that. That's what we're wanting to maintain and improve.
So given, do you think it's fair to say that you guys are in a period of exceptionally goodwill after this summer? I mean, does it feel like that to you?
I think there's no doubt about that, that after the summer, everyone in the Valley experienced the fire departments were kind of put front and center in what they do and what they deal with. And I don't think we've ever had a time where we've had generally better public support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So moving forward with that public support, with that funding, are you worried? I mean, are we going to see more Lake Christine style situations? Or
I'm very concerned about that. You know, the long term trends that, I mean, I'm no weather person or even, you know, I'm no expert on it, but I think we all know what climate change is doing. And I think the forecasts and the meetings I've been to all point to, you can expect more of those kind of conditions, not less. And those kind of conditions lead to the potential for large fires like that.
So I don't have a good segue from fires to books unless it's Fahrenheit 451, but Lacey, maybe not so much doom and gloom on your end, I'm hoping. What are we going to see at the library?
Yeah, no doom and gloom for the libraries for sure. It's very simple. You're going to see more books. You're going to see more audiobooks, more magazines, more books for your kids, more movies, more everything. It was really simple. When you're talking about getting more funding, obviously you want to go back and link it to your strategic plan or your mission. And it's really easy when you work for an organization where all of your staff are so on board with our mission and what we are supposed to do. And if, when it comes down to it, that we are supposed to provide exceptional resources to the communities. And it was a unanimous decision. We wanted to immediately put something tangible back into the hands of the voters. We have a number. We're going to put 14,000 more items in our district across 6 branches. So like I said, it's going to be impossible to not notice. My staff are quite literally rearranging things at the library right now because we have to make more space. It's really exciting. It's going to be like Christmas, like every week.
That's great to hear. Now, and we're not talking about a tax increase per se when it comes to Carbondale Library or Garfield County Libraries. Can you explain a little bit what's going on there?
Yeah, I'm really glad we didn't have to ask for an increase this year because so many other people were for equally worthy causes. I could swear it that they do this on purpose, that they make these tax laws and thresholds complicated just so it's hard to explain. But that's the way it is. So essentially what the voters were doing was that we were asking the voters to tell the state that we are allowed to keep all of the money that the voters have already voted to give us, and to not be beholden to thresholds of growth. And what that amounted to this year, and it fluctuates every year, was $139,000 to go directly to new library material purchases. So if we don't get that money, which if the voters had said no on 6A, that would have been refunded back to the taxpayers. The number was in between $1.30 and $1.50 per person. So it's
not even a slice of pizza.
Unfortunately, it's not even a slice of pizza. I can appreciate that form of currency. So it was really great that, you know, everybody saw that. And instead, they can get this much more from us all the time. Like I said, it was really hard to communicate to voters what it meant that somehow we'll get more money, but we won't increase your taxes. Mm-hmm. So, and to be honest, it's some of us don't even understand all of it because it's complicated. So
while we're talking the future of fire, talk to me a little bit about the future of libraries, because I know, they're not. They change over time. Their role in the community changes. What are they now compared to 50 years ago, and what do you see them becoming?
Well, two things. Number one, people still check out books. Believe it or not, people still check out books. It's a true thing. I see it every day. People prefer them. It really still happens. I know that everybody's trying to say that, you know, that we read digitally now and only that. It's not true. That's why we have lots of books. It's still great that that's the basis of how libraries began. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is not just a trend. It's just a status quo.
Trust me. I'm a newspaper person. Yes. On the radio right now. So, things that are supposed to have gone by the wayside.
You're out of there for sure. The second thing is that libraries, you would be amazed at the questions that we get every day. People expect us to know a little bit about everything, in town, about the state, about the schools, about services, organizations, everything. So the the scale of information and resources and organizations that we would like to connect to just based on what we see as a need in our libraries is staggering. So all of this gives us more, libraries have become more relevant just because of those things. Everybody sees us as, well, if you don't know, just maybe go ask the library. I don't know, you know? And if we don't know, we can at least tell you, maybe there's someone at Third Street Center that knows or something like that. So it's amazing. We get all sorts of questions.
It's funny you bring that up because I did have somebody earlier today tell me that if they were having trouble with their computer, they had a propensity to call the library.
We get calls about cell phones, about laptops, and sometimes we can actually help them. We can connect them to a database or something. It's amazing. And then we get requests for, obscure sheet music, obscure documents and manuscripts from universities all over the country. John was just preparing two ILL requests from California and Arizona. I'm glad that people think that. That's an obvious thing to me. But because it's true, you know, if it's not an answer for us to say, we just don't know. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, I'm not sure, but let's try to figure it out. Because if you're interested in it, maybe somebody else will be too. Mm-hmm. So
that, I think in that regard, we're kind of on the same page there. I do sometimes get a call from somebody who's researching something kind of obscure that is not in my wheelhouse. But there is an assumption that a journalist, a librarian, that our job is to find things out. And yep. I think that's fair.
It's really fun, too.
Speaking of that, we're going to go into history in a little bit there. For those of you who are just over election talk, we're going to talk about disease instead, which will be just a whole bunch of fun. But first, I should let you know that this is Katie and Kay, commercial-free since 1983. Underwriting on Katie and Kay is an effective way to market your business, reach your friends and neighbors in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond with Katie and Kay's reasonable underwriting packages. Email greg@katieandkay.org. Stay tuned for Valley Voices coming up at 4:30. For now, you're listening to Everything Under the Sun with Will from the Sun, Lacey from the Library, and Rob from the Fire Department. And Lacey and I think Rob to some extent, I know you've been around a while and at least care a little bit about local history and probably a little bit about epidemiology. But Lacey and I recently had a kind of nerd out together about the Spanish flu, or the great pandemic of 1918, which we're kind of, I don't know about celebrating, but we're in the middle of the centennial here. It's also the centennial of this weekend of the armistice, the end of World War I, which was the reason we have Veterans Day was originally based on Armistice Day. And certainly we want to honor that. There are lots of organizations doing events this week associated with that. The American Legion Post 100 has a meal. The Catholic Church is doing its elk dinner, which I understand might have some moose this year. And the schools are all putting on some events tomorrow to honor veterans. So if you're somebody out there who's could use that, get in touch with CRES in particular. I think they're looking for some vets to thank. But I went off on a tangent, which is Spanish flu. So Lacey, you were researching this back in your old gig as a historian in Eagle County.
Yeah, I too was excited about the centennial of a lot of people dying, psyched. But it's fascinating. It's a fascinating centennial. And like you said, the other history that it lines up with in our country, world history, it was a pandemic. It affected 1/3 of the global population. That is insane. That's something worthy to note for sure. At the time, I was trying really hard to connect local stories to it, going to different cemeteries. And basically, if your grave said 1917 to 1919 even, I was researching you and seeing, you know, if you died of Spanish flu, which is kind of a weird thing to do. But it's also really interesting because it's part of our history of the Valley. And when you think about how small these communities were, I mean, it could have decimated an entire town.
Silverton in particular, I understand, was just, 180 deaths out of a town not much bigger than that. It's absurd. I mean, we in Carbondale, based on what the Aspen Times says, we're doing a good job of keeping people out and avoiding mass death, but we still lost actually the editor of the newspaper to the flu shortly after, you know, on Christmas of that year. And if you go to a lot of little cemeteries out in the boonies that haven't been used since, you know, the teens or the 20s, you'll notice that, you know, almost a majority of the deaths are from 1918 or, you know, maybe 17 or 19. If it's such a disaster of worldwide proportions, more Americans died from that flu strain than in World War One. I mean, that's...
And more than the, I always say it wrong, the bubonic plague, too.
Right,
and,
although a different percentage.
But a different percentage, yeah. But it's just, they weren't even, in the newspapers, they couldn't have published everyone's obituaries. It was just numbers. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, so 500 dead this week and 300 reported dead this week. And that wasn't even, I mean, you know, today that would be all that we're talking about, front page news, right? But it's during the war and this is a weakness. And so it was on page 4 with, you know, little type text between the legal notices and my favorite part of the old papers, the local happenings, which is essentially social media of the late 1800s and early 1900s.
So-and-so got married. So-and-so grew a beard.
Yes.
So-and-so died of the Spanish flu.
So-and-so is visiting in Denver. You'll have to call next week. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, you read those in 1918 and it was people reporting in their local newspaper to tell their friends that they actually weren't going to come back. They're extending their visit somewhere or, you know, so-and-so does have influenza. And so that wasn't, it was still, you know, worthy news, but.
Which is how my understanding of why it ended up being called Spanish flu. It didn't start in Spain. It may actually have started in a little town or in Kansas and then moved to a training facility there and then moved all over Europe. It may have started in China. It may have started in France. No evidence that it started in Spain, but Spain was neutral in the war, and thus their press was a lot more public of what was going on there, which, you know, I think that speaks to the importance of a free press, right? That your ability to respond to something or know what's going on isn't helped if we're trying to boost your morale.
Well, if you're trying to appear strong during a war, you know, it's like the same reason why there were only 3 photos ever published of FDR in a wheelchair. He didn't want to be seen as weak. So it seems like a no-brainer. Obviously, you want people to know, but we don't want you to quite know that much because we need to have that front. So.
Yeah. But, the thing that I found really fascinating, you know, the contrast to Silverton is Gunnison, where, you know, once you acknowledge the problem... they blockaded the streets. They didn't let anybody who got off the train coming from the outside had to go into immediate, you know, seclusion. There were stops at the borders of the county, and if several people were actually jailed trying to sneak in, and they had one death in the county through that whole scenario, which compared to Silverton down the road, compared to Carbondale, you know, anywhere on the Western Slope, they're actually considered a model out of about 8 towns in the whole country of people who were called escape communities. They really responded to it. And this was at a time when vaccination wasn't an option, when, you know, we didn't even know what viruses were to start combating this thing. I loved talking to the state epidemiologist, and her sort of off-the-cuff comment was, you know, we've discovered influenza since this pandemic, which really helps with dealing with influenza.
crucial point.
Or, you know, she also kind of pointed out that, you know, we knew about the same amount about flu in 1918 as they knew about the plague in, you know, actually, I don't know the year, 1300s?
Yeah, 1350s, yeah.
Okay. Rob, though, I'm curious, is this something you think about? Because, you know, we've talked about the fact that the Carbondale Fire is also an ambulance service. Do you guys have concerns about, I mean, do you get nervous when flu season comes around? Or do you keep an eye on the rates of disease? Or is that a little bit out of your wheelhouse?
Absolutely, we do. And it's funny, when you were talking, my brother... is an epidemiologist.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Yeah.
But so I know a little about it from him, and then in my career and my business, we are very very cognizant of it. And it was interesting, you're talking about Gunnison. That's one of the early forms of infection control, right? I mean, the quarantine thing, and we still do that today. And but we practice the stop of disease spread every day, mm-hmm. right? And with things that are called universal precautions and our infection control protocols and how we deal with people, we offer our people flu shots and all kinds of vaccinations and get them, hepatitis B, you name it, everything we can, and we're very cognizant of it. And so when flu season comes around, we ramp it up. We even ramp it up around our stations to mm-hmm. make sure you're reminded to wash your hands. I mean, basic stuff, but that kind of stuff, and using every precaution you can when you're treating a patient, because it can, that little fire department there, people on crew living with each other for 48 hours at a time, you mm-hmm. can wipe out a crew for a week and a half because they all got the flu.
Sure.
And so we're extremely cognizant of that. And you can also, if you don't clean your ambulance out right or practice good technique mm-hmm. personally, you can give a patient the flu. And that's the last thing we want to do. So, yeah, very cognizant of it. And finally, I'm a big history buff. I know the Spanish flu story, and I didn't study it to the level that you guys did. It's awesome to listen to. I love that stuff.
Cool. Well, yeah. You'll have to, I don't know if you had a chance to read the story, but it's not a conclusive history of the flu in the area, but I think it'll make folks who are...
I love reading it.
Yeah. So it was interesting to go from sort of the history and how it came about and what the stew of issues, you know, from global travel, but not great sanitation and lots of folks living in close proximity with animals, so that you had kind of a wild birds, domestic fowl deal. And apparently Amy and Gavin have the same idea of peering in at us while we're trying to be on the air in weird ways. But anyway, it was an interesting deal. We got to tie it back to, what you can do now. How do you can avoid something like this happening in the future? And the answer wasn't just vaccinations. I know that's controversial to some folks, but also, you know, washing your hands, as simple as that.
And it was the same advice back then, too. Right. That I think that's the most striking thing that makes it so relevant. Mm-hmm. The advice was quarantine or stay home, mm-hmm. wash your hands. There were still talks of it being from avian flu or swine flu. Mm-hmm. We've all heard of those things, you know, mm-hmm. so it's still... It's fascinating stuff.
Nothing new under the sun. We could get back to our little title here. One last thing I want to note. Obviously, there's a great deal more in the paper, but we got to get into Valley Voices in a moment here. One thing there is a story on the soccer team, which lost last night. For those of you who didn't know that, we were not with that. Happened after the press deadline. We weren't able to get the info in there, but we did talk with those boys who have managed to get to the quarter or the semifinals this year, and that's an accomplishment. Certainly Rob as somebody who in a different sport managed to get to the state finals back in the day, I think that's what does that feel like?
Semifinals is a big deal. Uh-huh. And they should be really proud of what they did, because that takes a lot of effort and a lot of unity. It really does to pull something like that off.
Sure. All right. Anything either of you would like to add before we turn things over?
I just want to say thank you to Garfield County for supporting us this year.
Yeah, I agree. Everyone in the Carbondale Fire District, we're very grateful, and we'll do our best to make you proud.
All right. You've been listening to Everything Under the Sun on KDNK. Stay tuned for Valley Voices. Thanks for joining us.